Just enjoyed coming here a lot. So, I was asked to give this talk. I mean, when I heard the topic of the workshop, I wasn't quite sure how I'd fit in. But I think there's a place for me, despite not doing quantum gravity. And to my mind, a lot of the issues that you, if you're doing experimental quantum gravity and looking for signals of quantum gravity, one of the things you're going to have to worry about is the issue of how can it be consistent that short distance physics imprints itself on long distance observables? So hence the title. So some of this work is a little not old, mature, I guess is what I'll call it. Stuff I've done with a number of collaborators, and there's basically two sections that I want to deal with, and they are related but somewhat disjoint. And so the first part is some work that I did a while back with Cliff Burgess from here and Jim Klein from McGill and Cliff's student Lemieux, and it has to do with well, it has to do with this. Are inflationary predictions like the CMB and so forth, can they be sensitive to very high energy physics? Okay, and all the transplanking talk that we've heard so far, I mean, it's either a problem or it's an opportunity, as we'll see, but at any rate, we need to understand this. We need to understand the issue of whether or not there can be this short distance infiltration into long distance observables. So let me go through this and tell you why I think we should worry. I'm going to give you a couple of toy models that we came up with where this short distance infiltration does happen, but under a very controlled in a very controlled fashion. So and then I'll talk about how you can have, everything, having your cake and eating it too. So as both Jens and Robert have talked about, there is this transplanking problem or opportunity, and it comes about because, as far as we can tell, everything seems to be consistent with the inflationary paradigm for generating density perturbations, symmetric perturbations. So we have the WMAP data. I guess not so many people showing it in this conference. We did see the WMAP picture, but not these. But at any rate, the way it comes about, the way those perturbations come about, is that we have quantum fluctuations at short distance being set within the inflationary horizon. They get stretched out outside the inflationary horizon and then eventually re-enter the FRW horizon. At some point, by some mechanism that we can argue about, they decohere, become truly classical, and provide the source for classical density fluctuations. So the problem aspect of it is, is what Robert was just talking about earlier today and what Jens talked about on Monday. We know we need a certain amount of E folds to solve all the problems that we have in the standard hot Big Bang cosmology, 60 to 65. And generically, if you most models of inflation that you just write down, coming from from a field theory perspective, chaotic and so forth, it's actually very hard to stop at 60 to 65. You typically run for thousands of E folds. And so the bottom line of that is that if you look at scales on the sky today, they came from scales that were smaller than the Planck scale. So I guess I missed it because I was looking at you all. But you take scales that were up, in the sky, blue shift them back down, and if you have enough E folds, a lot of the scales that are making up the CMB sky came from sub-Planck scales. And so the first question you'd ask is, in order to interpret the WMAP data, do I already have to understand all about quantum gravity since I appear to be sampling physics at sub-Planck scales? And there's a distinction that needs to be made, I think. This argument certainly tells you that about the scaling, that we do have this blue shifting back in scales and the expansion and so forth. It's not kind of what's in play right now is whether or not the physics also stretches along with the scales. It may or it may not. We don't know. But if it does, then there's an issue to be dealt with that somehow very, very short distance stuff is showing up on essentially what you might argue is the largest scale observable that we have, the CMB sky. So that's the problem aspect. And of course, there's always dualities everywhere, right? I knew I was going to do that. Somewhere in there. So if it's going to be a problem, we can flip it around, right? I can't build accelerators that go to the Planck scale, but maybe I don't have to, because if I look at the CMB sky really, really, really carefully, I might be able to deduce at least some things about very, very short distance scale physics because of this effect. So there is this problem opportunity duality, and because of that, it behooves us to understand whether this can actually happen in a way that's consistent with what we think we know is right at longer distance scales. I mean, we were just having this discussion at the coffee break. I'm a firm believer in the effective field theory approach at long enough distance scales away from the Planck scale. So I kind of think that you should be able to do things. Field theory ought to work somewhere down the line. And we have to see whether or not the standard notions of decoupling are still valid here. And so, do we have predictive power? Any theory that has this infiltration from short distance to long distance is at least potentially going to have some problem with having predictive power, because it's basically, before I can analyze a CMB sky, I have to know everything. I have to know the full theory of everything down to very sub-Planckian scales. And so, the analogy I usually make is that it's like, teaching the freshman, and you can't teach the mechanics until you teach him all about quantum gravity, because it'll infiltrate all the way through. So if this is not going to happen, and it certainly hasn't seemed to happen, there's got to be some way of controlling this infiltration that somehow, if we really want to make use of this, then maybe, there's some way that this short distance physics comes out, but it's controlled. It doesn't show up everywhere, so that there's some sequestering, if you want, of the short distance effect. But it's not at all clear that that's what happens. It's not at all clear. And you might argue that until we solve the quantum gravity problem, that maybe we won't really understand how it shakes out. But we should be able to make some statements just based on what we're describing inflation through effective theories involving scalars and so forth. If we're in that context, within that context, I should have some way of understanding what's really going on. Okay. So the question really is there a controlled violation of decoupling that I can use so that I could actually have a shot at extracting some trans-Planckian information from the CMB sky? That's my question. And so what I'm going to do is try to give you some, not really answers, but examples where, within contexts that I fully control and understand, i.e. field theory, I can find situations where there is this controlled violation, seeming violation of decoupling. Okay? Which then, if you believe that that's not outlandish, then gives you some hope for believing that you could still control this other violation of decoupling coming out of inflation. All right, so that's the philosophy for this first part of the talk. And we can take a couple of approaches to understanding this, and just to sort of categorize them. There's been a lot of model building in terms of trans-Planckian phenomena, so modified dispersion relations, string uncertainty relations, short distance prescription, the sitter invariant alpha vacuum. Some of the proponents of those are here in the audience. Or you can try to use symmetries and general principles to try to make as close to generic statements as you can. Just because maybe you don't believe in a given model, or you don't believe in a given model. That's really it. And so what I'm going to do is mimic this trans-Planckian physics effect, this heavy physics effect. I'm going to try to mimic that by having a regular field theory that will describe inflation, couple it somehow to a sector that will be a heavy sector, and try to understand how that heavy sector feeds in to the inflaton sector. So that's the approach.
Of course, to make a big assumption that field theoretic methods are applicable, which is fair enough.
Well, I mean, if they're not, then I truly don't know what I'm doing, because I can't even calculate the spectrum.
No, it's not an objection. I mean, that
sounded like an objection. It sounded very negative. It sounded very negative.
Well, it's in my nature, No, but I meant it seriously, if it is a discrete space-time where the...
Oh, absolutely.
Of course.
But nonetheless, however that shakes out, at some distance scale larger than where that discreteness might happen, I should be able to use field theory.
In this sense.
Yeah. So that's why I think that looking at it from this point of view is not a bad way to sort out whether or not this thing can happen. Okay, so I'm classifying the two examples as non-adiabatic physics and adiabatic physics. And by which I mean, if you're really going to separate the high energy sector from the low energy sector, what you're really thinking about is, you know, from the path integral perspective, you're thinking about integrating out these other fields and saying that somehow by integrating out these other fields, I generate a whole slew of operators by contracting legs and Feynman diagrams and so forth. I construct a whole slew of operators in low energy field theory, and I work with those. The question is, can you always do that integrating out? So even if you think by just looking at the Lagrangian that, oh yeah, there's heavy masses here, light masses there, clearly I can integrate these fields out and generate the effect of Lagrangian. That's not the whole story. That's only the story if everyone's kind of sitting in the vacuum, essentially. But there's no reason to expect that. And in fact, generically, it'll take you a while to get to the vacuum. And so because of that, it is probably worth at least giving a shot, taking a shot at understanding what happens if some of the fields in this heavier sector are not in their vacuum state, but are doing something interesting. So that's the first thing. So what I'm going to assume is I'm going to have this heavy sector, and I'm going to have it be oscillating for a while. So it's just, so essentially, let me just go to the next one. What I'm really thinking about is having a hybrid model, two fields, the standard inflaton and some heavier field, and I'm going to have the heavier field doing something interesting. And it's going to be interesting enough and mixing in with the inflaton in such a way that it's going to be hard to understand what the low energy sector is and what the high energy sector is. And so the standard thing that you have in hybrid inflation is you have, like I said, two fields. Here's the Lagrangian. The important part is a potential. So what you have is a trough. So this line here is the inflaton direction. This is the heavy field direction. Okay, so along here, along chi equals zero, you have a trough which is supposed to be where the inflaton rolls. Okay, so it's you set things up by whatever, you know, by any means necessary so that this happens. And then eventually, when the inflaton gets to a certain point, in these other directions, the potential turns to having a negative mass squared, and inflation ends by falling into one of those minima. That's a standard hybrid inflation picture. And in all of this, what the statement usually made is that you are sitting on the trough chi equals zero. Okay? Well, suppose you're not. Okay, so suppose phi is trying to roll along here, but chi is doing something interesting. Chi has some non-trivial dynamics. There's no reason to expect it wouldn't. And if you're coming from some arbitrary chaotic kind of state initially, to actually have everything land exactly right, that's the fine-tuning. That's the more fine-tuned state than not. It's much more likely that you're going to get this, that you're going to get some roll along here and some oscillations along there. They get redshifted away, but it takes time. Okay, and that's the crucial point. Eventually, you want it to get redshifted away because you want inflation to kick in. So until then, you're in fact, if you start off with these oscillations dominating, you're matter dominated for a while. You redshift things out, and eventually you'll go into the inflationary state. So you can actually solve the equations of motion in this in the assumption. Well, here's the equation of motion for chi, where m phi now is the mass squared of chi, but it's going to be phi dependent. And when you solve for it, and if things aren't moving too quickly in the phi direction because you're trying to be in slow roll, you get some behavior like this for chi. Okay. Right. No, I'm not worrying about the fluctuations yet. I will in just a second. So what's interesting is, let's see what's really interesting. So there's a couple of things. If I want this to work, I have to choose the initial conditions for all the zero modes so that the effect of heavy mass, I'm going to have this under control. So I have to have the effect of heavy mass of the chi field to be less than the Planck scale so I don't have to worry about quantum gravity, but larger than the Hubble parameter during inflation, so that I have that separation of scales. And the whole issue here, I'll talk about it a little bit later, the whole issue here devolves from an analysis by Schenker et al. Arguing about what the size of trans-Planckian effects would be. And the question is, it's H over some new physics scale. That's the fiducial parameter. And what power of that shows up. And they argue that only H squared over M squared is going to be the leading contribution, and so therefore everything is unobservably small. And that deep down inside, that's what we're testing, to see whether or not parametrically that's what happens. Okay, so I need that. I have to wait for a while, like we talked about before, until the heavy field oscillation is damp enough so that the inflaton energy density kicks in and we start inflating. And so this happens, you know, you can actually solve everything. And what I now want to look at is the fluctuations equation, because that's where, if there's any, the question I'm asking is, can those oscillations in the chi field, in the heavy field, can those imprint in the CMB sky? Okay? So here's the equation for the fluctuations. And now notice, there's a contribution, the standard contribution from the zero mode of phi here, but now there's another piece coming from the zero mode of chi, and that's a damped oscillating contribution. Okay? And so you can solve this, and it's important for later on. So this will be going like a cosine squared, because I'm assuming cosine oscillations. And the cosine squared, if you do the trick, I can never seem to teach the students at school, that cosine squared is, you know, 1/2, 1 plus cosine twice the angle. That'll become relevant momentarily. And if only they would listen. So here's what happens. So what this picture is a picture of the modes, the new modes that you solve, that you get from solving that equation. This is a these are numerical solutions for different choices of the initial value of the heavy field and the coupling G, and different choices of how early we start the oscillations, okay? And different choices of what the mass parameters are in terms of the Hubble parameter. And what you see is that there's oscillation, and that the low K modes over here tend to be suppressed. And the suppression comes from, so the oscillations are coming from the cosine 2m piece of the chi squared. So that's what's driving those oscillations. The damping at low k is essentially driven because in that g phi squared term that's coming into the effective mass of the fluctuations, you have a k squared minus some piece over here. So the low k modes get suppressed because of that. All right? And they exhibit a peak due to the oscillations, and the peak is essentially at twice the mass. And modes that match this frequency at the earliest times are the ones that get enhanced. And so this is what happens for the modes. What happens for the power spectrum? So this is the power spectrum in arbitrary units. So I haven't superimposed WMAP data here because we just didn't have it when we did this. But the interesting things, depending on how I choose my initial conditions for chi, the initial amplitude of chi, the CLs change. So there is an imprint. There is an imprint of this heavy physics in the CLs. And in fact, in here you can see this is a blown up part of the low L piece. We normalize everything so that everything matches at this L. You don't have to, you could have done it with the WMAP data. But what you see is this low L suppression, the low K suppression that we saw before. So just as a total aside, if the low quadrupole is really there, you know, this predicts it, and we did it before they saw it. So I'm just saying. Okay. Yeah.
The background for these modes was computed using the full equation for phi and
right.
any fields.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. But you can see what's going on just from the fact that in the approximation that it's basically cosine squared, that's really what's driving all this. But we saw in the previous picture, we actually saw for the full modes.
But you're assuming chi is homogeneous, but phi is not homogeneous?
Right. But it's much more massive. Chi is much more massive, so whatever its fluctuations are doing is kind of irrelevant.
Well, it's doing something, so...
The fluctuations aren't. The chi fluctuations aren't. The chi zero mode is what's doing this.
But see, if phi is homogeneous, that drives the homogeneities in chi. And
sure, but those are suppressed by h over m to some power. Those inhomogeneities are suppressed by h over m. Those are suppressed.
Okay.
Compared to these, at any rate. Okay. All right, so the point is, weirdly enough, there's infiltration of high-energy physics into low-energy observables. How come, what's up with the coupling in that? And the point is, there wasn't really a separation of scales. What I have to do, if I'm going to really think about integrating out those heavy modes, I have to be able to separate all the mass scales. What I'm doing with this driving field is I'm actually populating extremely mass, I'm being able to populate the chi scales, the phi field, the inflaton field, to scales that are essentially above the cut, you know, at around the cutoff. So essentially, I can never say that's a cutoff and I have low energy physics below that cutoff, because I'm continually pumping stuff up into that regime. And so there is no reason to actually expect that there's a separation of scales there, because of this oscillation, because you're feeding these modes, yeah, as they keep getting depleted, you're feeding them back in. There's no reason to expect that you should be able to integrate things at that scale out. Okay? So, not a surprise, and so you may wonder if this is technically a violation of decoupling, but it may or may not be, but it's certainly close to things that could happen in inflationary models. I mean, there's no reason to expect that you just have straight up vacuum stuff and it just flows the standard way. Okay, so any questions at this point?
Can I move on to the next one?
So have you actually checked if looking at homogeneities of different dimensions in Chi and if that has a back reaction of this solution?
Again, that's all going to be suppressed. That's all going to be subdominant.
That will only tell you a limit for your scale.
I
don't quite understand why, because the zero mode, if the zero mode is a torsion, then it's not clear to me why it's non-zero mode aren't.
I can place this on zero ones. I mean, I have to tell you what the initial conditions for those are. So let me place them in their bunch, JV's actions.
It's not consistent set to zero because it implies homogeneous, that induces homogeneity.
But that's a light field trying to move a heavy field, right?
Yeah.
So there's got to be, in fact, a suppression that's closer to little m over capital M, which is actually worse at H over M.
Maybe.
Okay. We can talk
about
that.
Besides, even if it were true, even if something else happened, it would only serve to point it further.
Right. I mean, so you might argue about the exact pictures, and we can argue about that, but it would still be the essential point. There's still high energy physics infiltration.
Robert, didn't you do a calculation like this with Chi in homogeneity?
No, in a different
context. Okay. Okay, any other questions here? Okay, so this is what happens if you look at these non-adiabatic situations. Now, you may say, okay, well, that's a weird situation. I don't like that. Many have. So what we can actually do then is, are there models? So we can ask the next question. Are there models that where the fields are in their vacuum? There's no oscillatory behavior. And yet we can still get enhancement, or less suppression than we expected. Okay, so an enhancement of the effect of these high energy fields, okay, relative to the fiducial value H over M. And one of the ways to try to achieve this is, because of symmetry reasons, you didn't have any potential initially for the inflaton, okay? And that the only reason you have inflation at all is because you've integrated out these heavy fields and generated a potential for them via radiative corrections. So that's the only potential there is, and it's dominated, its sole contribution comes from these heavy fields. Then it's not a suppression at all. The fact that there's, you should expect to see large mass scales, large things showing up there, because that's the only reason that there's a potential at all. In the limit that, So what we should expect to see from this, if we can come up with models, is that there will still be suppressions of some mass scale over heavy scale, maybe squared. But it'll be different than H squared over M squared, and this scale M naught could be quite a bit larger than H. So we can still get in, there's still suppression, but it is much less suppression, even parametrically, than what you expected. Okay? And the question is, are there models that do this? I'll show you. It'll be better when I do the model. So, if I'm trying to argue that I really want to get rid of tree level potentials, I want to start off not having anything, okay, no potential for phi, then I need to invoke some kind of symmetry that prevents that. That would be the best way to do it. And supersymmetry is the best way to try it. And so, what we have is a theory of, first I'm starting with global SUSY, but we can couple this to a supergravity model if we need field ranges that are closer to M Planck to make things work. But so, just have a global SUSY with a chiral multiplets that have a charge under a U1, couple it to the vector multiplet in the standard way. Here's a Kähler function. Here's a superpotential we're using. Essentially, it's a supersymmetric version of hybrid inflation, and this was done by Copeland and Ryoto and others. If you look at the effective potential, here's what you get. I guess I cut off part of it there. Here for the F term and the D term pieces. And again, you have something like what we had before. We have a trough where these heavy fields H's, H for heavy, where the heavy fields are zero, and at large values of phi, the potential is just constant. It's just a pure constant. It just sits there. Okay? But I expect to be able to get something because the super, whereas the global minimum is supersymmetric, while phi is large and rolling, I'm away from that minimum, so supersymmetry is broken. So I should expect that there are radiative corrections that will actually generate a potential for me. Okay? So it will lift the flat direction. So there is a potential. You do the standard Coleman-Weinberg type calculation, you get this. And here's the upshot. So so this is what you get in general by doing the Coleman-Weinberg. Go to large phi because that's where you want to be to start your inflation out. And this is what the potential looks like. So there is some this has dimensions of mass squared. So there's some scale here. The bottom line is that, you know, first of all, for sufficiently small parameters, you know, the usual fine-tuning of inflation, I can get sufficient inflation. The more interesting part is let me compute the slow roll parameters. Okay? So here they are, here's epsilon, here's eta. And you would have expected there to be sort of, you know, there is large mass, these are the large masses, this little m squared here, that's the large mass in the problem. And you would have expected to see h squared over m squared suppression. There is a suppression, but it is parametrically different. And in fact, it can be quite a bit larger numerically than what h would have been. It's mass of the phi field at some fiducial value when certain scales leave the horizon. Okay? And so the bottom line is that the comparison, again, is not to h squared, as you would have guessed if you had just done a straight up power counting analysis, which is what Shanker and company did. All the suppressions are p squared over m squared, p is order h squared over m squared is what you get from just looking at the derivative expansion, essentially. And here, there are reasons for why that does that. For why that analysis breaks down. The bottom line, let's see, am I right?
A squared is part of your delta.
Right, right.
State proportion. Huh?
Oh no, h squared? No. Delta is just involves the particle physics parameters. So there's no h squared here.
There's no
right. And this n is just if you couple it to n of these chiral multiples, just to see the enhancement effect from that perspective. Okay, so those are the things to look at, and those are the things that are not h squared over m squared. And so again, there is this infiltration of short distance physics, but there's a reason for it. There's a symmetry reason. There was nothing there before. So anything that you get is coming, you know, will have this, you know, have this signature of the short distance physics showing up in it in a unexpected sort of way.
Couldn't be that the delta in some sense is proportional because it's associated with some correlation.
No,
from
I mean, I didn't write it down, but delta just involves g squares and bev squares, and it's just a particle physics. It's particle physics information.
Because that's to do with the fluctuations of the.
No. So in fact, I mean, I didn't show it here, but you could actually calculate things involved in the fluctuation. So you can see that there's running of the spectral index and so forth, and that depends on these things. So the bottom line is, as I said before, I mean, the reason we got started worrying about these sets of issues had to do with this analysis by Shanker and company, where they were arguing that no matter what you did, it would always be h squared over m squared suppressed. And that would seem to be at variance with what the model builders were saying, that, you know, Ulf had models where there was h over m, I guess Jens, you did too. And the question was why was there such a mismatch and you know, between these things? And could you codify where the mismatches would be, or was there a right answer or a wrong answer? Okay.
There's one thing you didn't mention, which for me is central, namely the retrofit. It takes Planck scales and evolves them into low scales.
Sure.
For me, that's a thing that was missing in Shanker's work, because they took perturbations as generated and Hubble rings cross.
Absolutely. That's like going to be in the second part. At least what I have to say about it will be in the second part. So what I would say is that even if you don't factor that in, suppose you don't worry about that sort of, you know, call it UVIR mixing if you want, right? Even if you don't worry about that, just from a standard field theory perspective, there are ways, although the generic situation is what they said. If you don't put fields in certain places and don't look at specific classes of models, the generic field theory will do more or less what they say in their analysis in terms of the derivative expansion, not including the effect of the full redshifting of the mode. Okay? But on the other hand, so that's a generic situation. But on the other hand, there are loopholes in the argument. You can actually make use of these loopholes to argue that it's not outlandish to think that there might be some remnant information in the CMB coming from short distance physics. It is not, but again, you do have, so probably the safest way to say it is that invoking decoupling in these situations is a lot trickier than it would otherwise appear. And even in the field theory situations, you can see where the trickiness comes in.
Comment, I don't know how it fits the way you're presenting things, but to me there is a very sharp difference, and one should try to maintain it, between a heavy scale that is characterized by a heavy invariant mass of your fields mm-hmm. and a scale associated with a particular frame. I mean, those scales that we say are microscopic scales and are transplanted scales are only transplanted in the cosmic microwave background field. It's a field dependent, it's a frame dependent, so compared with the frame invariance.
Absolutely. So I'm doing everything. So I kind of fall back on Robert's comments earlier this morning. I'm doing everything in the cosmological in the cosmic time frame. I'm splitting my. That's where I do my inflationary calculations. I mean, that's where when I look at my fields rolling, I'm doing. That's the background I pick. I'm looking at rolls in there. So from that perspective, I'm fully consistent in the way I calculate. Okay.
No, I'm not playing.
No, I know, but I'm saying that certainly if you could find a background independent way of doing everything, that would be better, and you probably would have a tighter answer as to what happens with the things. But in this context, I think I'm okay. Yes.
I'm still a little bit confused. So on the previous slide, your argument was based on computing the slow roll parameters, right?
Well, amongst other things, I mean, so for example, also if you actually did the CLs, okay.
But those are different things because this is really based on derivatives of the potential, whereas the argument that Schenker, Kalper et al. Used was comparing things at horizon crossing, which enters the H squared to
sure.
Which is encoded.
Sure. But actually, but this
to the high energy scale, whereas this is a
beast
here. So I don't.
Well, they're not so different. I mean, these five stars, like I kind of glossed over it, but these five stars and M stars are at horizon crossing. These are evaluated when certain scales cross the horizon. So that information is encoded in there. Okay, and it's more encoded. If I'd written down the spectral index and the running of the spectral index, you'd have seen it a bit more clearly next time we'll do that. Okay.
I think I have a related question, actually. Maybe this is similar to what you're trying to say, is that these are corrections, essentially, to the zero momentum mode of the input pond.
Or
all analysis, it was the H squared of rem squared came in, and the, you know, essentially, the invariance of sort of the P squared.
Sure.
It was
a derivative extent.
It was a non-zero momentum mode.
Sure.
Sure. More in.
Right. But in terms of whether or not you can actually make, just look at the effect of Lagrangian and make these statements. So just from that perspective alone, I would argue that you can't, not generically. So the detailed arguments that they make are exactly, they look at the kinetic term P squared, they're doing a derivative expansion, right? And just saying P squared like H and F rise across and so forth. But what I'm arguing is that if you try to just do things from the effect of Lagrangian and not worry about some of these more subtle issues as to, you know, whether, so the thing here is that any correction that you're getting is a correction to zero in this case. And so any correction to zero is real big, right? And that's part of, so generically, so like I was saying before, generically they're right, but they're missing some important corners and loophole space. Okay, and this is one of them.
Well, there is really a loophole here as well, which is because related to this difference. So you're assuming a mass increase to be coherent over the horizon for Hubble scale, right? At least in the previous example.
Right.
Which is not consistent, because if you have a massive field, it would be oscillating. If there's a small
sure.
phase difference, it would be coherent.
Sure, but once I start inflating, I'm in an inflationary patch.
Yes.
So, you know, whatever anyone else is doing is all good.
Based on a small phase difference initially, then it wouldn't be coherent over the Hubble scale. It would be oscillating with different phases. and you would have like a, you wouldn't have this coherent oscillation. So
sure, but I mean, it's the same problem. I'd have the same problem with the inflaton, right? I mean, if I don't place it exactly at the right place, and I don't, you know, kind of do it within that region.
The inflaton is light, but this is very heavy. And
so, I mean, I would argue it's less susceptible to the fluctuations than the inflaton would be, right? The spread of the inflaton is going to be much larger than the spread of the heavy field, right? I mean, that's why you don't use, that's why you don't use heavy field to try to inflate, right? When M is much less than H.
Okay, we're going to discuss this.
Okay. Any other? We're good. Okay. All right, so. Right, so the point really is, I mean, there is a facet of having one's cake and eating it too, in that it is true that you want to believe in decoupling. Decoupling is good. Decoupling is a good thing. You should be very wary of violating it. But there are places where, you know, don't call it a violation, but I kind of want to go all Hillary here and find extra words to explain things, but there are places where you can actually find ways where high energy physics can find its way down in a controlled fashion. So let me leave it at that. And the control is important because if it came in, if any short distance scale could infiltrate any long distance scale, that's it. Physics is over. The reason physics works is that we can separate the scales and do physics a scale at a time. Okay? All right. So now what I want to turn to is, it's different, but related. And this has to do with the theory of inflationary effective states, work I've done with Hale Collins over a number of years. And it's related to things that were talked about by Jens earlier in the week and by Robert this morning. And so we have to try to understand how to deal with these. What is the initial state of the inflaton? That's what it boils down to. How do we pick the initial state of the inflaton? And we'll talk about sort of the standard prescription, but if we're going to try to understand whether or not transplanctonic physics is real, whether we can do something with it, whether we have to worry about it, we're going to have to learn how to calculate in the presence of these modes, and we're going to have to learn how to calculate in a reliable fashion. So the tool for doing that, I mean, this is not a new problem in physics where you have a theory that kind of works, there's a deeper theory somewhere else. We know how to deal with that situation. And it goes by the name of effective field theory. And it used to be, you know, when I started in this game, it used to just be a set of words, but now it's really a very coherent type framework in which one can do calculations in a reliable fashion. And the standard tools are great, but because we have this expansion, because we have this redshift of modes Robert was talking about, there's some modifications that you have to make to the standard approach of effective field theory. And then we can use that to how to figure out how we're going to specify an initial state. And then how are we going to talk about what initial states really are allowed? We've been having a sort of a running discussion about whether or not non-adiabatic or non-Hadamard states are allowed. And as you'll see, my argument is that they are, and it's effective field theory that lets you say that. But I imagine at some point we'll still continue having a vigorous discussion. So let me remind you or tell you about what the philosophy of effective field theory is. You have physical phenomena, and somehow they occur at energy. There's some scale M that is a dividing scale between the physics you know how to do, which is scales lower than some M, and the physics that you don't know anything about, which is at scales higher than M. So there's some physical separating line. So it might be going from the quarks to hadron. So something happens at lambda QCD. You don't know how to make that transition, and so forth. So what you do is, you make use of the low energy theory fields and symmetries, and that fixes the renormalizable part of the theory. That fixes the relevant and marginal operators of the theory. The higher energy physics appears as higher dimension operators, the irrelevant operators, suppressed by powers of the scale M. And sort of the canonical example is to go from W exchange in the standard model, integrate out the W when you're at energies much less than that scale, to come up with the Fermi fermion theory. Okay, and if you look at the effective operator that gives you this vertex, it's a dimension 6 operator. It's suppressed by MW squared, kind of the way you expected it to be. And now, you know, when Fermi started doing this, this is what he wrote down, this is what he had. And now we understand how to do the matching so that the coefficient of this operator is now related to something in the more fundamental theory. And that's how it usually works. If you know what's going on at the higher level theory, you do a matching calculation, and then you can do the low energy physics with predictive power. Okay? So this is a consistent way to do physics, because you expect that if you have experiments at a scale E in your low energy regime, all the high energy physics may well come in, but it's always going to come in suppressed by E over M, or powers of E over M. Lee.
Yeah, some people like effective field theory, some people don't.
Damn, get that.
Yeah, no. It seems to me a crucial issue that behind those arguments is, what if the symmetry of the high energy theory is different from the symmetry that we know? For example, something that's very relevant for this
right.
is, what if the Poincaré symmetry is deformed? So if you do effective field theory using Poincaré invariants, you would see a different analysis than if you do effective field theory governed by a deformed Poincaré invariant. And you see still something different if you think that Poincaré invariants is broken, Lorentz invariants is broken.
Right. So I think so. I mean, you might hope, although I guess this is probably not correct, you might have hoped that by adding enough operators, I could mock up the effect of not having Poincaré invariants. I guess that's probably not what would work out.
Well, so say a point that's key for quantum gravity is that the distinction between broken Poincaré invariants and deformed Poincaré invariants is both relevant at order 1 over m prime. But in the one case, there are, for example, dimension 5 operators mm-hmm. which are relevant, which are ruled out in the second case. So if you're just naive about the application of effective field theory, you can come to...
Well, I mean, I think that... I guess I'm not totally sure how to answer the question fully, but what you could do, I suppose, is just to... If you have a hint that maybe Poincaré invariance might not be the great thing in the full theory, and somehow you're seeing it in some bizarre guise in the low energy theory, is you can do what people have been doing here, is add more operators, but now break some of the Poincaré invariants and just classify those operators again in power counting, but with less symmetry than the full Poincaré. So you have rotational invariants only and things like that. So that's
you get a Viruand effects than the one over the theory you'll find tomorrow with the field theory. I mean, if you add extra terms that break the symmetry,
mm-hmm.
what we have figured out is that by adding extra terms that break the symmetry, you're introducing more Viruand effects than actually the
full
would be with the deformed symmetry, because it's a softer modification. So actually standard field theory cannot capture those kind of...
If that's true, I mean, there must be some, from the field theory perspective, that would have to correspond to some violations of some of the violations of the standard things we believe in field theory.
Right.
So,
but precisely, it does correspond to violations of standard locality, but in a very controlled way. And that's something which is not captured by just adding more operators to the Hamiltonian around you.
Well, I mean, if I had some, I must be able to decompose a non-local thing into, if I do a derivative expansion, capture more and more of the non-locality, right?
Well, it's not clear. So, for example, if space-like separated commutators are not zero but fall off exponentially, this is again Michele Arzano's example, the consequence is deforming into space-time symmetries. And I don't think that phenomenology is captured by throwing on more even in...
So, I mean, there's no derivative expansion that captures that, really? I mean... Okay, I mean, I defer to you on that because I have to look at it, but I mean, I'm...
It's a sort of derivative expansion. The derivative expansion is actually an expansion in terms of, you can view it as something that uses the translation generator of your space-time
mm-hmm.
account, okay? And there is an analogous expansion in the form series using the translation generator of your whatever non-local picture of space-time you have. But that doesn't translate into, you cannot rewrite it faithfully in terms of...
We can talk about this a bit more later afterwards, but I mean, there's got to be some horrible mismatch problem. I mean, I know that in the low-energy world, up to relatively high energy, Poincaré symmetry is good. The effect of field theory works. The derivatives expansions kind of work the way I think they do. So if there's some horrible transition at some point, then I guess, yeah, I might not expect effective field theory to capture that. But why isn't it showing up all over the place? I guess, why is it? How can it be so controlled and not infiltrate everything all the time, I guess, would be my first question. So basically saying I don't know much about that aspect of it. Let me go on. We can talk about it later. Okay. So in the context that I'm looking at, standard issue field theory, you might need an infinite number of operators to capture the entire theory, but in practice, you only do experiments of some finite resolution. And that typically means that you'll have only a finite number of operators that you really have to keep to see it, you know, to capture your experiment that you're doing at whatever energy you're doing it at. So that's the effect of field theory as I understand it at any rate. In a cosmological background, things are a little bit different. The first thing that changes is the question that you're asking. Typically, if I'm doing scattering and so forth, I'm calculating S matrix elements, and I have my asymptotic states. It's a boundary value problem. I set things up out there. They come in, scatter, go back out there. In a cosmology, I don't want to do that. First of all, in some space sites like the sitter, the whole issue of whether there is an S matrix is pretty problematic. So I'm not sure that's even, those are definitely not the right questions to ask there. But generically, that's not even a question I would ask, at all. What I want is a time evolution of expectation values. I want to know I have the inflow time field, which is the expectation value of the quantum field. I have that zero mode. I want to see how it evolves. I'm computing expectation values, time evolving expectation values of two-point functions of inflow time fluctuation. I want to see how they evolve. So the questions I'm asking are different. In fact, what I'm really doing is switching from a boundary value problem, which is the S matrix approach, to some kind of initial value problem. Okay, and the issue is going to be, how do we initialize? And technically, what that involves doing is doing the Schrödinger-Keldysh formalism for computing time evolution, basically computing the time evolution of in matrix elements. Okay. So what that's going to mean is I'm going to have to specify what the state looks like. And in this initial quantum state, if I'm going to do effective field theory, I have to do effective field theory, not just for the operators, but for the states as well. So the states will have some structure. If I look at look at their mode expansion and so forth, their frequencies and so forth, there's going to be some certain amount of k behavior. And I have to make sure that the quantum state also satisfies the strictures of effective field theory. So long-distance features, the IR stuff, I will measure. Short-distance stuff, I'm going to parametrize, because that's the stuff I don't know. I'm going to parametrize it somehow, and I'm going to do a matching. And so, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do the usual thing. I have an evolution of the state given by some time evolution operator. I'm going to take my field and expand it in the usual way. And for k's less than m, so scale m that's set by whatever physics is out there, I'm going to say I understand that physics. For the short distance stuff, I'm going to say, well, as we'll talk about later, the thing to start from is at least as much Davis vacuum. And I'm going to say there's modifications to that.
What is beta c?
It's the initial conformal time. We'll talk about that. That's going to be an issue in just a second.
Yeah, m is a conformal scale.
M is some mass scale of your theory, in your particle physics theory.
So a proper scale. So you can't compare it to a conformal k.
Right. I mean, so this is schematic. It's important. I'll get to that in a sec. Okay. So, but the point is, I will encode all the stuff I don't know for the short distance things. I'll encode them in some fashion that is a parametric fashion, and it eventually I will do various matching calculations to figure out what these coefficients should be. And that's what you do in effective field theory. So let's go back to how we specified the initial state and essentially why there are concerns. The usual way is we have our massless, minimally coupled Klein-Gordon equation for the fluctuations. You get your two solutions for them. And what you do is you pick the coefficients of those two solutions such that when you go to short distance, very short distance, k eta goes to minus infinity in the de Sitter case, you get you match the flat space vacuum, match the Poincaré invariant vacuum in conformal time. And that seems reasonable. right? That's not an outlandish suggestion, because at short distance, you shouldn't be able to tell that you're not in flat space. You can't see that far, right? So it looks flat to you. And of course, it's a de Sitter invariant vacuum, so you're happy about that. But suppose the dynamics changes at some scale. So sort of the easiest thing to look at is what happens in QCD, for example. As you get down near lambda QCD, pions aren't pions anymore, they're QQ bar. And you start to be able to resolve some of that, okay? Suppose it happens with the inflaton. The inflaton, suppose it's composite. Suppose the physics changes, okay? Then what do? I mean, all of a sudden, you want to go all the way down to short distance and set your vacua using that short distance prescription, but it's not valid. It's not valid because you're doing the wrong physics after a certain point. After the scale M, you're doing the wrong physics. And so you have to figure out how you're going to set your vacuum from that perspective. And that's exactly the problem that effective field theory is set up to solve. So a more reasonable thing is set up initial conditions for your modes. Instead of this just being the standard frequency of the mode, set something more arbitrary up and have your real mode be some linear combination of that Bunch-Davies mode that you would have gotten by matching to the flat space vacuum. And so what you have then is, call it a structure function that gives you extra information about what's going. It encodes, it doesn't have the information because you don't know the information, but it tells you that there's something new going on at short distances that you're parametrizing. Okay? And we write it this way just because it makes it look like the alpha vacuum case. But there are many ways that you could parametrize it. But the point is, you have to include the possibility that there's short distance physics that's tipping you away from the standard Bunch-Davies vacuum. Yeah, did you look? No? Okay. So now the issue of when do you set this time? If you really believe that there's some scale M, some proper scale M, past which you can't do this physics, when I take modes and I redshift them back, eventually I'm going to cross that scale. Okay? And so what I need to do is have some understanding of how I'm going to pick this earliest time that I can trust, where I can trust the standard physics of scales less than M. One way to do this, so we've been arguing about this, but you know, so one way to do it is take all the scales that you care about, redshift them back until they cross M, and they'll cross at different times, but pick sort of the latest time nearest us. So that's one prescription. There are other prescriptions that one can use involving, say, just pick a pivot scale that encodes enough L's in your CL expansion that you care about, and choose the time such that that pivot scale hits the scale M. So you can do it that way as well. There's a number of ways that you can play this game. But there is an initial time past which you can't trust the physics anymore if you're doing the inflaton physics. So I'm going to pick that time. Okay? And so what that sets up is some initial time hypersurface, you know, that I can't really think about doing physics before that, not at least with this theory. So I have to initialize all my fields on that hypersurface. Now, how do I propagate things so that I can do the Schwinger-Keldysh stuff and so forth? Well, the propagators need to know that I've imposed boundary conditions on that hypersurface. So I have to make sure the propagators encode that. These two terms would have been what the propagators would have had with no funny boundary condition information. There's a new term that you have to put in, especially if you want to make sure that when you compute loop diagrams, you don't get what are called pinch singularities. You have to put another term in that encodes that boundary information. So the propagators have to change in a manner to be consistent with the fact that you're setting information up on this initial time hypersurface. Yeah, it's unique. If you don't want to have the pinch singularities, you're forced into this.
And that is not derivable from any Lagrangian.
No, I mean, there's a path integral that you can. So given the field, like, there's a path integral, the conditions are a little bit different that you have to impose on the path integral. But there is a path integral way that you can do this.
So for each k, you're going to just pick freely an alpha k?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Now, isn't this equivalent to just saying that is this initial time where you don't understand what's going on? Instead of using the regular Bunch-Davies vacuum, you just apply an arbitrary Bolyubov transformation at that time.
Right, I do that, but I also change the propagator. So if I just did a Bolyubov transformation, I would get other terms would show up in here.
Okay. Like a, so that's not just a
box. It's not just doing that. Right. Mm. Right.
This produces particle creation? No.
Particle creation relative to the body.
That's why
you're
asking that.
Particle creation is not
yeah.
That.
Okay, so.
But alone, I doubt that you would get.
We'll see.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll see in a second. So. So essentially, what this thing encodes is it encodes some infrared observable infrared aspects, which are like excitations above the ground state, and these UV effects that have to do with sort of adding up all the physics I don't know and matching to that surface. So they go on to wherever the next theory is.
And why don't they back react on the background state?
I'm running out, but okay, but oddly enough, I should ask a question. So, what you really want to ask is, can I renormalize the theory? Right, and with all these effects, given the fact that I do have some over the UV modes, can I renormalize this thing in a correct way? And so what we found with that propagator, so we chose that propagator so it's not to have these pinch singularities. With that propagator, here's how it shakes out. You compute, let's compute something. Okay, so for example, let me compute correction to the equations of motion. That's one thing I can compute. I'll talk about the stress energy in a moment. So let me compute that. So there are going to be a lot of divergent quantities that are going to show up. But what happens with this propagator is that the divergences break up into two separate parts. Ones are parts that live at all times away from that initial time hypersurface. And when you look at the form of those divergences, they're exactly of the same form that you would have had if you had no hypersurface there. Okay? So they're exactly the form that can be canceled by the standard counter terms of the theory. Okay? There's a new category of divergence that has to do with the fact that you have that hypersurface that encodes all the stuff that came before it. So there's a divergence due to that. But all those divergent terms you can show live on that hypersurface. They do not propagate off to modify the what you might call the bulk part of the physics. Okay? So all that stuff lives over here. So I have to include a boundary field theory that lives only on this hypersurface, but when I do that, I can renormalize the theory completely. Okay? So there's a standard renormalization in the bulk, and then there's a boundary theory that you have to renormalize as well. So as an example, so let me parametrize my structure function in this way. So I have pieces that grow in the IR. So when k gets, here's the omega k, the frequencies. When k gets small, these pieces are important. When k gets large, these pieces get important. Okay? So this is a total parametrization of my structure function. And that will give rise to divergences. What happens? If I look at, just let me look at 5/4. The new initial condition looks like this, and it involves these d coefficients, here and here. And when you look at what you have to do to the boundary theory, is you have to renormalize the divergences coming from d0, you have to add this operator to the boundary. For d1, you have to add another operator to the boundary. So this would be a dimension 3 operator that lives on the boundary. Okay? When you do that, all those divergences go away, and likewise, if you look at in the UV, the same thing happens. If I include a C1 here, I have to include these operators to cancel off the divergences. But they all live on that boundary. They never propagate off that to screw up the renormalization of the bulk. So as a final thing here. What happens to the back reactor? So one of the big problems, right, if you're going to modify the state, why doesn't that modification essentially, if you want to call it particle production and so forth, why doesn't that modification of the state back react and even stop you from inflating in the first place? With so much stress energy and these weird particles, it just stops you from going on at all. And that would happen, if you get a big contribution from the non-bunch Daviesness of these states, you would get that problem. But if you're doing effective field theory right, and you've done, and you can really do this matching properly, the leftover pieces that you get, you take care of your divergences. The leftover pieces should be small. That was the whole point of going through the exercise in the first place. So here are the energy density and the pressure in terms of, this is e to the alpha k, it's just a different notation here. But here's a structure function. Here are the standard pieces that you would have gotten, and here are the pieces coming from the parts of the propagator that have the structure function in them. So now compute the divergent pieces. So basically what we do, we essentially calculate the tadpole. We force ourselves to be in the right vacuum, that we still have the Einstein equations by making sure that the tadpole vanishes. So here's a tadpole in this theory. It's a mess. You have to evolve forward and backward in time with Schrödinger-Keldysh, and you get all sorts of stuff. The bottom line. Right, you set that to zero. So you want to make sure that you still have the right equation of motion, even with all these corrections.
Well, this is consistent with the fact that you assume that your Lorentz symmetry is preserved.
That's so right.
Otherwise,
sure.
So
well, absolutely. I mean, I'm in that game. I'm in the low energy theory. If I don't have Lorentz theory symmetry.
Because in general, this would not be zero.
Right. So let me suppose I had some Trans-Lankin type correction that scales up as positive powers of k. So these things really screw you up, right? You'll be getting big contributions from these particles. So the bulk part, as I said, the bulk part of the stress energy renormalizes in a standard way. It's under full control. The only thing that can give you problems is what's happening at the surface. So here are the divergent pieces, and you can absorb those into boundary counter terms. And when you compute the renormalized version of that and compare the surface contribution to the energy density versus the vacuum one, it's always suppressed. It's always parametrically suppressed, h squared over m Planck squared, and then other powers of h over mu physics scale. Okay, so the back reactor, those particles do not contribute very much. It's under control. And this, at least is, you know, from our point of view, is a resolution of fights between Green and company and Ferrati and company about whether or not back reaction was going to stop you from inflating at all. So let me just get this in the final conclusion. So the bottom line is, the question is, can we imprint high energy physics in short distance, in long distance physics? Can we do it in a controlled fashion? And can we calculate? And I think the answers are yes, yes, and yes. Although I think the generic answer to the imprinting question is that generically, you don't see much, but yes, it can happen under certain circumstances. This boundary effective field theory approach to the initial state gives a way to both parametrize a new physics and calculate the effects reliably in a totally controlled fashion, in taking care of all the divergent stuff by renormalizing the boundary theory. And from this, it's not a bad bet. I mean, if you have a lot of money to blow on stuff, it's not a bad bet to put some of it on looking for quantum gravity in the sky, because it's not inconsistent, probably, with what we know how to do. Thank you.
Other questions?
With respect to the boundary effective field, mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things there is that Richard Easter and Brian McHarris and I wrote a paper about
right.
this in the context of the Green et al.
Right.
stuff. And what you find is that you very appropriately look at issues of the normalization of stress energy in mm-hmm. that case. But when you're actually trying to use it as sort of a phenomenological model for looking for imprints on CMB, mm-hmm. you end up having terrible problems because of all the effects that the ultraviolet. And so that you're modifying CMB on really short wavelengths where you have good control over it. That was what we found, at least with Brian et al.'s paper, was that you ended up with very small effects near the quadrupole and huge effects at an L of about 200 to 300, right? Because of the fact you're using a constant time hypersurface, so that shorter and shorter wavelengths are getting closer and closer to your cutoff, and you're expecting larger.
Right, but you can't, I mean, so that's basically saying that you're getting exactly the place where the effect of field theory breaks down.
Right.
So.
But that's only when you choose a vacuum state for the modes on a constant time hypersurface.
Mm-hmm.
And if you like on Richard's, I'm sorry, on Robert's ignorance. Right. So you're using the bottom zone of
right.
ignorance to set the boundary conditions. Where I mean, we've argued that the proper zone of ignorance, the proper boundary surface where you're really normalizing the modes is every mode you're doing it at a different time. Sort of
so so you've got a timeline, so yeah. You've got a time, that, I mean, which, that's a bad initial value problem, right? I mean, if you're thinking about really solving this as an initial value problem and time evolving your correlation functions to late time, initializing on a time-like surface like that is unsettling at least, right?
Yeah, but that's what procedurally much Davies vacuum is, you know, you're sort of taking every mode to infinity independently.
Well, so it's you're taking it to the initial to the space-like surface at infinity at 8 equals zero, right? It's very small, but it is a space-like surface at 8 equals zero, or 8 equals minus infinity. So. So from that perspective, much Davies, if you do that.
No, what you're doing is you're normalizing each mode on its wavelength is independently on its wavelength is sampling that ultraviolet.
I mean, I would.
That's another prescription you can.
We've looked at your stuff a little bit, and we kind of want to be doing the calculation doing it our way, because I mean, I just have this feeling that if you're really doing effective field theory, you should have taken care of all the ultraviolet stuff already before you started. You should have resummed that all up. Already, long before you start. So.
So I guess I would say that's probably an intrinsic limitation of the field.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's why it's effective, right? Somewhere it breaks down.
But again, for this problem, fluctuations in pressure and quality, I think that it's not.
In particular, the answer you get, for example, for the modulations for CMB depend on what initial time you pick for your hypersurface. They're strongly dependent on that, and so that I would think that if effective field theory were really giving you a reliable answer in this case, that it would be independent of the time you choose for your initial time hypersurface. It's not.
Well, but I mean, effective field theory, the answers that you get when you do the matching depend where you do the matching, right? I mean, you know, there is a physical place where the physics changes, right? I mean, I think that's the problem with things. You guys interpret it differently, right? The physics doesn't change at that surface, right? It's not like you have new degrees of freedom or anything like that, right? In your approach? That's our view, is that, you know, at that surface, you just don't know what you're talking about anymore. And so that's why you have to do this.
But there's these two zones of ignorance. So I think this is exactly the point. It's not only the time-like the space-like surface, which you need to put your initial data on, but also, you know, the boundary at that fixed scale n. So I have a related question. We shouldn't restrict the discussion to the CLs only. It goes on to smaller and smaller scales. So we could talk about cosmic expansion today. We know that we are still living on an expanding space time.
Sure.
And as Starobinsky and Tkachev have shown,
right.
If you're a little bit away from the adiabatic vacuum now, you would run into problems with cosmic particle production even now. So,
but I mean, but
you handle this in
yeah, because I mean, because the way you would run into problems that the stress energy in those particles would be too large. But we just showed that the stress energy from these other particles, whatever you want to call them, is totally under perturbative control. So that's a small effect. Once you do the renormalization properly with these boundary states. The renormalization, the contribution to the stress energy from those particles is totally small.
So I want to broaden the discussion out again to the issue of the reliability of effective field theory. So tell me if you agree with Colin, I'll give you an example. In effective field theory, in this kind of context, like inflation, is useful within a certain class of ideas and models to sort things out. But there are interesting things that might be actually true about the universe that it can't contain. So for example, you know, supposing that the topology of the universe is actually very complicated. Supposing that scattered through the universe is a gas of Planck scale wormholes, which have a property that the rate to traverse them is very small. Say the rate is, you know, for a quantum energy E to transverse them is G E Q.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just scattered randomly about. And if they were there while the universe was inflated, they may even inflate it away by now. But they might have left imprints in correlations in the sky that you could never capture with effective field theory, because there's no way such a modification of space-time structure could be captured by derivative expansion. But if you believe that the universe, you know, if you believe that the classical geometry is factor description arising from some quantum geometry, you might very well expect that that there are, you know, that locality is an approximate concept, and locality could be disordered in a way which on cosmological scales could be very significant, but locally would be hard to see.
There actually is, well, sort of an effective field theory description of the kind of thing you described. If you think back to the time when we were talking about space-time wormholes, you write down operators in your effective field theory that are not local operators. They're, say, bilocal operators.
Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't think to do that. I agree with you. But you wouldn't think to do that if you were restricted to the class of ideas and quote effective field theory as we just
talked. I mean, but those operators were exactly that category, right?
So they didn't look like anything from usual local effective field theory. But then, if it's really the case that, say, those make an imprint on the state early on and then are sort of not relevant any longer, then you would expect everything to be described by effective field theory. Local effective field theory from then on out, so they just affect the initial state.
Supposing I didn't know anything from the last 10 years of discussion, I said, look, there's some distribution of fluctuations in the sky, there's some correlation function. Maybe that correlation function is really a correlation function that arose because it was a gas and wormhole very early, and there was some correlation function that described those bilocal operators. I'm not advocating that as a point of view, but I might in another context advocate that as an interesting idea to play with, but the point I'm making is that there are plausible ideas from the point of view of background-independent quantum gravity that are not captured by thinking too conservatively about what you mean by locality.
That I won't deny. But if I'm doing inflation, I'm already thinking I've got an FRW-type background, I've got a field, so I've already kind of erased, at some level, I've kind of erased all those possibilities. So
it goes back to my question, if a ball of the space-time changes.
Then
you cannot do it.
Right? Yeah.
I think one of the questions in all of this is how can we modify our basic framework, but yet match on to the great successes of effective field theory? And for example, WMAP data and so on, that's something we've got to match on to if we're going to come up with some new idea for how things work. And that seems to be non-trivial when you collect all the things you need to match on to.
Right, but I would think that something like what we've just been discussing is not excluded and could be easily studied, and I agree.
It's hard to tell, right, without a concrete realization.
You have to make a prediction about what it is.
Right.
And if you can get this curve, then from some other model, great.
Well, you can certainly get a scale invariant distribution fluctuation. I could show that tomorrow if you like. I wasn't thinking that I could show that. You can get a scale invariant distribution fluctuation from the random gas of wormholes because the random gas is scale invariant.
I think we should distinguish between things that will affect only the initial state, which we of course have no direct, no other access than by looking at the inference in the CFD, and things that change the theory with which we are supposed to be working today. When we want to change the theory which is supposed to be working today, we then have to match. Not only that, we need to match everything that is every success of the standard model of particle physics.
Yeah, absolutely, but
and then that's very hard. But explain why effective field theory works there and not in these very specific cases that I would want to compute motivated by
those are interesting questions. But John Ellis said, we should be on the lookout for quantum gravity effects that could not be explained by anything from conventional quantum field theory. And if we work in a domain where there could be quantum gravity effects, when we stick too closely to conventional quantum field theory, we could miss things.
Yes, but the converse is if we stray slightly far away, we're probably going to get garbage. I mean, there are way more things out there than garbage.
There's a sweet spot there that we're looking for.
Yes.
There's a what?
Sweet spot.
So actually, that, after this color, we should probably move on to the next slide. So both dinosaurs also talk about this country.
Yeah, it's a fucking interesting work. Work as before.